This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Now, Democrats in the U.S. House of Representatives passed a measure yesterday to fund the government and lift the debt ceiling, along with other spending measures. Republicans in the Senate, though, say they'll block the bill. Without action from Congress, the government could shut down next week, and in a matter of weeks, the Treasury Department would be at risk of defaulting on its debt for the first time. It's the week in Washington. We'll talk about that and the latest on the investigation into the January 6th insurrection. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you worried about this idea of a possible government shutdown, of the federal government defaulting on its debts? Do you have memories of the many times in recent years we've been on the brink here? Do you want to see Democrats and Republicans work together? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas at WPR.org. Kyle Chady is a legal affairs reporter for Politico. Kyle, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be here.
A lot wrapped up in this debt ceiling thing, because there's a funding bill at the same time, all these infrastructure bills out there on the sidelines too. Could you untangle the debt ceiling part of it for us, Kyle?
Sure. Well, as you mentioned, everything is sort of collided together. We always get these sort of cliffs in Washington where there's a hard date when, these apocalyptic deadlines approach, and they tend to get tangled up. Yeah, the debt ceiling issue is one, it comes up every, couple of years or so where it becomes a political hot button, where you have, usually, when Donald Trump was in office, the Republicans didn't seem to have an issue raising the debt ceiling. But now that Joe Biden is there, they're returning to sort of the, making it a kind of a political football where, they treat the debt ceiling as though it's a signal of current spending, when it really just reflects spending that's already happened. And so what we're seeing is Republicans essentially saying, we are not going to vote for a debt ceiling increase. It's got to come from entirely from Democrats. So the has to pass on a sort of party line basis. And Democrats are grappling with that procedurally right now, what bill to attach it to, and whether they can get the support to make it happen.
I want to give a listen to Democratic House Majority Leader Steny Hoyer talking about this bill on the floor of the House yesterday. Here's a listen.
This is not a Democratic debt. It's not a Republican debt. It is our debt. It is the debt of the United States of America. We don't welch on our debts. We pay our debts.
What happens if we don't pay our debts, if we don't raise this debt ceiling, and what, we default on our debts? Can you talk a little bit about what kind of impact that could have, Kyle?
Yeah, well, I mean, we've seen a short-term breach of the sort of debt limit, and that has economic repercussions. The nation's credit was briefly downgraded, and I think anything longer than something that brief, that was a decade ago, or close to it, anything that's more than brief could have really catastrophic economic effects. We had Treasury secretaries of both parties writing to say, don't let this happen, even for a short amount of time, because we're in the middle of a pandemic right now, a halting economic recovery from that, and anything like that could really slow that down. So these are macroeconomic questions, but they could have real, repercussions for the way the country is emerging from the depths of the pandemic.
Now, I'm guessing Republican senators don't want to see a default here, but they, Mitch McConnell, very clear, he doesn't want his caucus to vote for this. There might be a few exceptions. What do you see as the political calculation here from Senate Republicans?
It's just the idea that, voting for a debt limit increase while a Democratic president is in the White House is not good politics, or it is good politics to sort of say, try to pin that debt on the current White House, even though, again, it reflects spending that happened years ago. So the debt that's incurred under the bill and, the bills that Biden has signed, that's not even really what we're talking about at this point. That will come at a future date, possibly under his administration or a future one. The calculus, though, is it's just never good for Republicans to sign on to any debt limit increase with a Democrat in the White House. And that's why they're at where they're at now.
Let's bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Michael is with us in Appleton. Michael, hi.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. My comment or thought on this whole thing is just that I think it's ridiculous and frankly offensive that the Republican Party is trying to pull this kind of nonsense again. You know, as the guest alluded to, they have no problem raising debt ceiling under Trump or when a Republican is in office. But as soon as as soon as they feel like they can score some political points with their base, they completely change tack. And I think it's just reflective of the fact that the Republican Party at this point, it really has no ethos except to oppose the Democrats.
Michael, thanks a lot for calling in. Kyle, do you think that's fair that Republicans are aimed at blocking a Democratic White House?
Yeah, I mean, essentially that's true. It's really not much of an argument against the debt limit increase beyond that, other than to make a statement that you don't agree with, you know, federal spending, even though, again, it's federal spending that's already occurred, and this is about paying those debts. And this is why you see Democrats talking a lot about, you know, we need to just eliminate the debt ceiling, that it's sort of an antiquated measure that really is no benefit to going into default for the country. In fact, there's only, you know, catastrophic effects that can come from that. So why we should eliminate this artificial ceiling that we confront every few years and get submerged in the politics of everything.
Thanks for that call. We're talking to Kyle Chaney, legal affairs reporter at Politico. He's with us today for our weekly look at some of the top stories in Washington. We're going to talk more about the debt ceiling tomorrow. Now we're going to move on to the January 6th attacks on the U.S. Capitol and the legal fallout from that. You can join in with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. Investigations going on in the U.S. House right now. Who do you want to hear from? What testimony do you want to see? Should the public see it or should it be behind closed doors? Do you have questions for our guest about what the January 6th committee in the House is investigating? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our roundup of the top stories in national politics. Kyle Chaney stays with us from Politico. You can join at 800-642-1234 as we turn now to the January 6th insurrection and an investigation in the U.S. House of what happened, what went wrong that day. Kyle, what kind of things is this select committee in the House investigating January 6th? What are they working on right now?
Well, this is just an investigation that's massive in scale and in scope. You know, they want to look at not just what happened on January 6th, but the preceding months in which President Trump sought to undermine the election results, fight it out in court, and then ultimately help assemble the crowd that turned into the riotous mob at the Capitol. And then also the aftermath, too, and how that's played out since Trump left office. So it's a really ambitious investigation, but one that they are trying to do, you know, much faster than Congress usually does, because they know they may only have a few months until the political season gets underway, and Democrats lose the House, and the investigation would stop in its tracks. So it's pretty massive, and they're about to enter a phase where it's going to move really quickly with subpoenas and trying to get people to testify who may not be freely willing to do so. So it could get very difficult and interesting soon.
And I know you're interested in the relationship between the top representatives from each party heading this committee, an unusual buddy act here.
Yeah, it is very unusual in that, you know, you see these relationships emerge from time to time in Washington, but Liz Cheney and Benny Thompson, the two leading members leading this committee, have developed in very quickly. I mean, they never interacted prior to the formation of this committee in June. And now are inseparable. I mean, they are texting and talking every day. They developed what I would consider a warm relationship that members and staff we talk to say is very genuine, partly born by the shared trauma of January 6th and their agreement in who's to blame for that. They both blame Donald Trump for it. But they're also under a lot of pressure, and I think have used that to really forge a bond that's helping the committee become more productive.
We're seeing new documents come out this week related to what happened on January 6th, including a legal advisory document from John Eastman. This came out in the new Robert Woodward and Costa book. This detailed a plan, a timeline for Mike Pence, then Vice President Pence, to, in effect, overturn the election outcome. What do we learn from that? Is this something that this committee might be interested in?
Unquestionably, they'll want this. If they don't already have it, they'll want to obtain this. It's not now. If you followed this at the time, John Eastman was representing Trump in court and had made similar arguments to the Supreme Court about how the justices could overturn the results on sort of the same basis. So his arguments about Pence are in of a piece with that. But it's when you see it on paper, it really is kind of shocking to see that what they expected or wanted Pence to do was essentially unilaterally say, no, Donald Trump is the winner. I'm going to ignore these Electoral College votes because I don't consider them valid and take it into his own hands. And Pence ultimately did not do that, but this was an official plan that the president's attorney in this case was pushing.
Can you talk about the timeline now for this January 6th investigation committee? As you mentioned, they are trying to get things done quickly, using subpoenas maybe soon to speed it along. Is there a thought that they would have a final report by X date?
Yeah, so nothing specific, but Benny Thompson has said he wants it done by spring. He says they'll do what they need to do to get a comprehensive report. So if it takes longer, it takes longer. But spring is the goal, which, again, when you set that against things like impeachments and previous investigations that take years to really bear any fruit, this is a very fast timeline for Congress.
And is the thought that there are going to be public hearings where witnesses who get a subpoena are going to be, you know, televised testifying, or is this going to be a quiet, behind closed doors kind of deal?
It'll be a mix, and they're kind of going case by case. I think they all recognize that this is a massive public interest and they want things to be done in public. But at the same time, there's going to be a lot of sensitivity about certain witnesses, people who may want to come forward that aren't comfortable with the spotlight. And they also want to talk to witnesses without necessarily telegraphing to other witnesses what they might be saying. So I think they're going to have to balance it with each, you know, the public interest here with those investigative prerogatives. And that's the signal we're getting, is it's going to be a mixed bag of those things.
And Kyle, over the next week, what story are you watching for next?
It's that list of subpoenas. We're told within the week, possibly, you know, tomorrow or Friday, we could find out who the committee is going to subpoena in the first wave. We're also going to find out within a couple of weeks whether Donald Trump's going to invoke executive privilege on some of the stuff they're trying to obtain. And that could spark a legal fight. So a lot of crucial decisions coming up in the next week to 10 days.
Kyle, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks for having me.
That's Kyle Chaney, legal affairs reporter at Politico. He was with us today for a weekly look at some of the top stories in national politics. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. TikTok, it's not just for viral dance routines performed by teens. It's also for dance moves invented by scientists right in the lab. Our next guest has found success on TikTok with her educational videos, as well as her entertaining posts, including one that features dance moves invented during late nights at the lab, like the spray it down, the pipette jab, and the conical tube shake. Lena Vincent is a PhD candidate and NASA Finest Fellow studying astrobiology and prebiotic chemistry in the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She's also a passionate science communicator with more than 40,000 followers on TikTok. Lena, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Well, before we get to the TikTok and the dancing, I want to talk about your field of work. All you're doing is trying to figure out, you know, how life started on Earth and could start on other planets. A big question. Tell us a little more about how we try to figure that out.
Yeah, so the science dedicated to answering those questions is called astrobiology, which is defined as the study of the origins, distribution, and future of life in the universe. So astrobiologists use experiments and simulations to try to answer those questions of how life got started on this planet, whether it exists on other worlds, and if it does, how we go about detecting it.
One question that I think you've answered from a viewer on TikTok, is there something special about our planet Earth here that makes us unique in being able to produce life, or is it thought that maybe there's a lot of other planets that could have the same conditions?
So the short answer to that is we don't know. So we only have one example of a planet that can sustain life and one example of life, meaning the example of life here on Earth that shares a common evolutionary history. And until we have another example, either if we find it on another world or we're able to synthesize it in a laboratory, we won't really be able to say with any kind of certainty whether there's only one type of life possible and only one set of conditions, be that combinations of a host star and a planet and the properties of those planets that sustain life. So we just don't know at this point.
Now, these are big questions, and it's plenty to keep you busy as a researcher. What inspired you to want to go out, though, on social media, TikTok, and elsewhere, and try to share a lot of this with members of the public?
Yeah, so the origin story for my TikTok science communication is kind of funny. So I downloaded the app last year around the same time a lot of other people were at the height of the pandemic, just to disconnect and have fun and consume some entertaining TikTok comedy. But it wasn't until fairly recently that I discovered this new side of TikTok that I hadn't really seen before, this kind of learn on TikTok movement, where creators were sharing educational content, be that, you know, how to use different photo editing software, making a budget, and then, of course, science content and science communication. And I don't really know what pushed me to kind of throw my hat in, but what's funny is my first video that I ever posted had nothing to do with astrobiology. It was actually a tutorial on how to use PowerPoint to deliver effective presentations. And that blew up. And then a few weeks later, I was like, you know, I wonder if I should start talking about my science, whether there'd be interest. And sure enough, there was. And so I kind of transitioned into more science content. And here I am.
And 40,000 plus followers and counting now. So there is interest. And looking at some of your videos now, it's kind of self-sustaining. People are sending you questions that they're hoping you'll tackle on TikTok.
Absolutely. I mean, I am certainly not going to be running out of content pretty much anytime soon. I have a few ongoing series, including, you know, discussing different alternatives to the kind of life we have here, kind of speculating about different forms of alien life, talking about the origin of life. And there are just endless questions and endless areas to explore, which has been super fun.
We're talking to Lena Vincent, PhD candidate at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery, studying astrobiology, and a science communicator, having a lot of success explaining some of these concepts on TikTok. Well, you mentioned speculative alien life. You've got a series you call, this is a new one, I think, Astrobiologist Rates Aliens, where you look at movie aliens. I don't want to give a listen to one of them now. You rate the aliens in the movie Arrival. Here's a listen.
If I had to nitpick, I would say that it does still kind of look human. That top part at least looks like a torso. But all in all, I think the creators did a really good job coming up with something that was intimidating, really cool looking, and yet somewhat recognizable. So I'm going to give it an 8 out of 10. Next up is plausibility. Now, we don't know very much about the biology and physiology of the heptapods. The only thing we know for sure is that they don't ever come down to the Earth's surface. They stay in orbit. And what we see on the screen is actually their equivalent of an AV system that they use to interact with humans. So we could take that to mean that they don't come down because their physiology is not compatible with Earth conditions.
Now, I love these. I watched a few of these, Lena, and I like it because you're not just there to, you know, debunk and scold people for getting it wrong. You want to kind of meet them halfway for creativity and plausibility. What got you started rating movie aliens?
So I've always dreamt of making a series like this. I was inspired by a kind of YouTube series by Wired, where they have experts react to different, you know, film and TV depictions. Things like, you know, linguists reacts to different accents and languages. But then I also, you know, for my TikTok content was trying to think of how I could diversify the points of entry. So what would get people interested in astrobiology, and the kind of low hanging fruit were alien depictions in mass media. So I thought it would be a fun way to kind of alert people to the fact that this is an actual area of science. And these are the kinds of things we can speculate about or be critical of with that area of expertise. So, yeah.
Yeah, it's a good conversation starter, right? I mean, how plausible is this feature of the alien? Why are these aliens just humans with different hairstyles? That's more of the early days of Star Trek, I think. Do you find that gets a lot of response from people and gets them talking and thinking?
Oh, absolutely. And honestly, the main response is, you know, wanting me to rate more aliens. And I think the way that those videos are broken down, you know, separating plausibility from coolness, especially, is giving a lot of fuel for conversation, you know, about how the limits of plausibility in creating entertainment value, you know, so just because something isn't scientifically plausible necessarily doesn't make it any less cool. So that's the fun thing about all that.
Yeah. Oh, and I said movies. You've also done video games. You've got a lot of material to work with there that could keep you
right.
Busy for a while. Now, I got to ask, I opened up by mentioning your lab-related dance moves. You've got a lot of videos, or a few videos at least, showing different lab-inspired moves. Tell us about some of those, please.
Yeah. So, you know, in addition to the more educational content where, you know, I kind of sit and talk about stuff. I also definitely hop on trends to stay relevant, and I try to adapt them so that they end up having something to do with science or astrobiology, just kind of as a fun way to, you know, show that I'm a person that is more than just a scientist, you know, as a job. And so, yeah, a hit was these kind of lab dance moves. So,
yeah, I think my favorite one was, did I shut the refrigerator door or the freezer door or something like that? So it's like lunge out, lunge back. And that sounds like my daily life, actually, not just lab work. So why is communicating scientific concepts with the public such an important part of your work for you?
Yeah, you know, so science communication is kind of a non-negotiable for scientists, and really cultivating those skills is valuable for a lot of reasons. I mean, one is being able to communicate and share the value and impact of science really is crucial. Science is not done in a vacuum. It's not done in isolation, and people need to understand what we're doing and what our discoveries mean for them to mean something. But I think one unexpected benefit from communicating science that I've really come to appreciate through TikTok is that communicating science is the way to get people excited about your science. And when other people are excited with you, there's no greater motivator to keep doing that science. You know, so doing science is hard, especially as a grad student. So if you can get other people excited and passionate with you, and kind of advocate for you and keep you going, I think that everyone can benefit from that.
Now, a lot of science is fairly complicated stuff. How do you try to set the right tone for your public audience in terms of how complex you get into the things you cover?
Yeah, and that's a really great question. And it's particularly important with TikTok, where it's these very brief videos, you know, of maximum 3 minutes, which is an extra challenge for science communication. But what I found, the recipe that works, if there is a recipe, is keeping it relatable, finding points of common ground. You know, technical depth is great, and that's the temptation of scientists, but often what works best is going in just enough depth to get people interested and making them care about the subject. And there's always room for technical depth later, but particularly with TikTok, it's about hooking an audience and making it relevant.
So what is next for your social media empire now? What do you have your eye on in the future?
You know, we'll see. I would love to keep doing this, to maybe expand to other platforms like YouTube, where I can create longer form content. But mostly the rule I'm going to be sticking by is listening to my audience and seeing what they want me to do. So that's the immediate plan.
Do you take requests for
Absolutely.
Alien?
Absolutely. I would say, you know, 80% of my channel is in response to requests.
My request, I saw a movie when I was a kid called, I think it was Terror Island, where there are these silicon-based blob creatures. I'd love to see your read on that someday. I remember it being a good movie, so it might be worth your time.
And it sounds like I will have a lot to say about it.
Excellent.
So you got it.
Lena, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you for having me.
Lena Vincent is a PhD candidate and NASA Finest Fellow studying astrobiology and prebiotic chemistry at the Wisconsin Institute for Discovery. She's also a science communicator with more than 40,000 followers on TikTok. You can find her there at Charm Quarks. That's Charm, Q-U-A-R-K-Z. Maybe you can request your own alien. I don't know.